We have the miracle of social media to thank for our latest episode of Soundtrackin', after I reached out to the one and only Alan Silvestri on Instagram. And gentleman that he is, he very kindly invited me to meet up with him on a recent visit to London. Alan is responsible for some of Hollywood's most memorable scores and themes, from Back to the Future and Forrest Gump to Castaway and The Avengers. In recent times, his long-standing relationship with Robert Zemeckis is perhaps only matched by that of Steven Spielberg and John Williams. As if that weren't enough, he also wrote most of the music for the classic TV show Chips. Thank you so much. The power of social media, by just dropping you a note, and you very kindly said, yeah, come on down.
Yeah, it's great. It's so great to do this. It's fantastic. And to meet you in person and talk on the phone.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. I'm just going to move that a little bit there. We've had the pleasure of having some people that you've worked with on the show already. Mr. Zemeckis, some time with, and the Russo brothers recently as well.
Good for you.
And your ears must have been burning,
let me say. That's fantastic.
But do you mind if we go back a bit?
Sure.
Because what's been wonderful about making this podcast, so much of your music has featured on this show through a lot of people, Nancy Myers as well, who's been on the show.
Yeah.
But what was the inspiration for you to want to marry your music to picture?
Well, I would have to say that I really needed a job. I think it's a quote, I believe it's connected to Hoagy Carmichael. I'm pretty sure that's who it was back in the day. And someone said, where do you get your inspiration from? And he said, the phone ringing. So that's not all of it.
Of course.
Absolutely. But the reason for putting it that way is I had never thought about film scoring. I was in L.A. I was struggling, just trying to stay alive, working, playing, giving lessons, anything I could do. And this out of nowhere opportunity came, and I did it. And the movie was a small movie, but it made some money, and now I'm a film composer. And so then another one of these films came my way, and little by little, there started to be the beginnings of this thing that looked like a path, and it was a film composer's path. Yeah. And then, you know, things just kind of went along, and here we are.
Friendships and relationships can be a massive thing that lead on to things. And you've this relationship that you've had through your work, but personally with Robert Zemeckis has been extraordinary. And for us as film fans, this relationship and what you work on together has been amazing. How did that start? Where did it start?
Well, that's, you know, a fantastic story. I had been out of work for over a year. You know, I had done that Chips show for 4 years, I think, and then it went away completely.
Yeah.
And I had been out of work for over a year. Sandra and I had our first child. Life was starting to look bleak again. And I got a call on a Friday night
I love that you remember the day of the week.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Yeah, it was from Tom Carlin. Tom was the music editor on this movie called Romancing the Stone. So he said, I'm working on this film. There are these guys here. They've been listening to music. They're just not finding anything that's they're sparking to. Would you be willing to try something? I said, absolutely. Yeah, let me check my book. Right? So he says, I'm going to put someone on the phone. And this guy gets on the phone. He says, yeah, Al, this is Bob. So, I got this movie. This guy and this girl are running through the jungle. Federales are shooting at him. It's raining. It's like a big action thing. And, could you do like 3 minutes of that and come in tomorrow morning? So, I had learned by this time that the answer is always yes, sir. So I said yes. And I had just started to put a little home studio together, the original Lindrum, the original DX7, Yamaha DX7. And I had a little multi-track tape machine, no mixing console, no reverb, no outboard gear. So I started to put this track together based on what he had described. It was ultimately the gorge cue in Romancing the Stone. And what's in the movie is pretty much what I did.
Wow.
Stayed up all night. Because I didn't have a mixing console, when it came time to mix to my little cassette, I did it by adding longer wire from things I wanted to be softer. And kind of got through this. And then I went into the meeting the next morning. Tom took the cassette from me to play for himself, to make sure he wasn't going to make a fool of himself, walking into Mr. Zemeckis and Don Camburn, who was his editor. And he said, oh, wait here. And he went and got this man, these two men, Robert Zemeckis and Don Camburn. And, the great omen was when Bob walked in, he was wearing the same sweater I was wearing. We were wearing our Calvin Klein sweaters. And we kind of looked at each other like, oh, what's going on here? So we played him the cassette. He was lovely. He said, thank you so much for doing this. And, we've got a lot we're dealing, but we'll talk to you. And I went home. And so that was Saturday and didn't hear anything. Sunday afternoon, the phone rings. Sandra answers, and her coloring changes very quickly. And
I just add that Sandra is sat here I can see her nodding.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. So Sandra, it's just like there's a little coloration change. It's like, are we okay, hon? What's is there's been some bad news? And she puts her hand over the mouthpiece, and she says, "It's Michael Douglas."
Oh my
and
God!
So I say hello, and it's Michael Douglas. And we start to talk about all of this, and he was great. And he said, well, look, just send me, anything you have, tapes and all that, and we'll go from there. And the call ends. And immediately when the call ended, I knew I had made a mistake because I had not found a way to meet him and be with him in person. And so I immediately called Tom back And I said, I need to talk to Michael right away. And he said, I can't give you Michael's private number. He said, let me see if I can reach him and ask him to call you back. So like 10 minutes later, the phone rings and it's Michael Douglas.
And he says, again.
Yeah, he says, hey, Al, so what's up? What do you want? I said, well, you know, I'm going to be in town tomorrow because I lived outside of town.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I could just drop the tapes and things off in person. And he says, no. You don't have to worry about that. You know, just send the stuff over and that'll all be fine. Well, I said, I'm really going to be very close. And he said, well, what time are you going to be in town? I said, anytime you want. And my recollection is that he laughed because, you know,
yeah.
He knew what, yeah. You know, that this was okay.
Yeah.
You know? And so I went to his office and I sat there and had this amazing visit with him. And I think it was very helpful in my having the opportunity ultimately to do the movie. So there you are. Now I've done this big studio film and it was successful, which was key.
Yeah.
It was Bob's first film outside of the world of Mr. Spielberg, which was very important that he make this on his own. And Bob and I just had this amazing rapport and I was with him 2 days ago and we're talking about The Witches, and I think it's our 23rd film together. And when we were at the Museum of Modern Art, they were honoring Bob, and he mentioned something about us working together this long. And he said, I think at that point it was for The Walk. He said, yeah, it's been 22 pictures. And then he went, in a row. You know, so he's never gone somewhere else. And it's one of the most extraordinary things. I think other than Mr. Spielberg and Mr. Williams, there hasn't been anything quite like that.
And how does it work with you now? You know, you talk about The Witches, which I'm really excited about as well. And does he send you the script? At what point are you, you know, how did that relationship develop from that point on to work across this amazing collection of films?
Yeah.
And really different films as well. You know, that's not, it's a great thing about Mr. Zemeckis is that he's not a genre-led director. And his last film, which we talked to him about, Welcome to Marwen, which I adored, I thought it was fantastic. Extraordinary. I love the surprises that he gives us as film fans.
Yeah.
So how did that relationship develop in terms of where you start the project?
Well, this time I'm in considerably sooner in a sense than on anything that's come before.
Yeah.
So there were scripts and I'm reading along, reading revisions, but this time he's actually been sharing the assembly of the film with me. So I actually have already half of the film. He has not really even begun his editorial process. Mm-hmm. It's just being assembled. So we are scheduled to score first week in April at Abbey Road, and we're this far in front, which is amazing.
Do you like having more time on Sunday?
Absolutely. And you know, being part of his process, it's fantastic. So, you know, that's kind of how that's gone. We've been together so long, and I have to assume there's a level of trust there now after all these years. And it's just, there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
And working with someone who he just, you know, you just always feel supported. You
yeah.
can try things. And, you know, the worst he'll say is, I don't get it, which is Bob Zemeckis speak for, it's really beautiful. It's not going to be in my movie.
I love as well, you know, I talk about how he's such a versatile director,
yeah.
but that also then allows you as a composer to be an incredibly versatile composer.
Exactly. Well, for instance, he is one of these incredibly knowledgeable students of film. So when we got to the end of Back to the Future 2, he showed me the Western. Remember him saying, well, Al, we're going to get to do our Western now. And then when What Lies Beneath was being prepared, he said, well, Al, we're going to get to do our Hitchcock movie now. And so you can just tell as a student of film
yeah.
that he loves to go and explore the art form.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he is not genre driven. You never know what he's going to walk in and say. And then the lovely thing about it is he doesn't pigeonhole music or composers either.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't get the guy who does Westerns or girl. Or the man or woman who do tension scary movies. Mm-hmm. He calls me and he's just like, I'm gonna figure it out.
You can do it.
Figure it yeah. out.
But that's the thing, you know, you've created these amazing themes over the years. You know, you mentioned mm-hmm. Back to the Future and more recently with Avengers as well, but then you also have created these amazing subtleties in films as well. And Forrest Gump's one that I talked to Mr. Zemeckis about in particular, because there is so much so many needle drops in there exist in music, and to create a score that just nails it emotionally, but also connects all these other sounds that are already there. Can't imagine that was an easy score to do, but what you did with that was wonderful.
Thank you. That was one of those instances where theoretically it was terrifying. A number of weeks before we were going to score, I would get a call from Bob, and he'd say, I've been looking at the film, Al. There's going to be a lot of music, a lot of score, a lot of score. And then 2 weeks later, I'd get the call, I don't know if there's going to be any score. And so we, in theory, talking about the film, were apprehensive, I could say, about spotting it and how can this possibly work. When we finally sat together and the songs, the needle drops, were basically in there, we just watched the movie. It was probably the easiest spotting session we ever had. It was absolutely clear to both of us where score was going to be and where it wasn't going to be. And that was that. I mean, it was such a pleasant surprise to find that the movie... there's always this thing called the movie. You know, if we just listen to the movie, it's going to tell us everything we need to know about what we need to do.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how that works. So it turned out to be, we looked at each other like, that wasn't such a big deal. So
what's the opposite of that? What has been the most with Mr. Zemeckis in particular?
I would have to say the most uniquely different would have been Castaway. Thank you. again, Bob will allow me my sensibility until, you know, as the captain of our ship, he'll say, we're not going there. But this was a case where we sat and we started to watch the movie and everything happens, you know, the whole opening of the movie, the plane crash, we're on the island for a long time. And he sits literally right next to me, closer than this, right? And after about an hour in, I could see he's once in a while glancing over at me. And at one point, he literally said, so you're not hearing anything? And I just, you know, I knew we could always go back. And I said, but... And it turned out that until our character left the island, I just didn't hear any score. And it's interesting because, you know, it's a movie. So you can't really say, well, we don't want to put score in because it needs to be real.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's nothing real about it. It's a movie. And there are camera angles and light and all the rest of that. But there was something about, the first of all, the magnificence of Hanks's performance, right? And the fact that because of that, because of Randy Tom's sound design, the closer we can get to the feeling of desolation, desperation, without shoring it up with this other layer, the better. And then for me, a whole new change happens, a big change when he leaves the island. For me, in a sense, that's where the movie begins.
Yeah.
Up until then, for me, it's all set up for what now is the heart of the movie, which is someone coming back from the dead, coming back into his world, and having to deal with the fact that he's been dead for all these years. He's a ghost in his own life, and it's all gone on. So that's a good place to play music, and that's where we started.
Get to that point in your career where you go, you don't need me in this part, you know, that's that's an incredible confidence to have, but also selfless place to be in terms of, it's about what's best for the movie, it's about what's best for the story.
I think Bob will he has always, he's got such a nose, I think, for honesty, and I've seen him selflessly cut things that I know he's cared about and worked so hard on for the benefit of the film. And if he feels that I'm coming from there, he's willing to explore it. There was a moment in Forrest Gump where Jenny's left, and Forrest is sitting in a window seat, and Bob's done this incredible long, I believe it's a push-in to him. And normally that would clearly be a place for some kind of music.
Yeah.
And I remember watching and watching, and we had a conversation about that. We're not hearing. And I said, you know, I don't know, Bob. I just feel like it's so powerful as you move in on him. And then when you cut to him and he's putting on those shoes, it's kind of like something's happened now. And he was magnificent. He said, okay, Al, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take it to preview your way.
Oh, wow.
And we're going to sit with an audience. And he said, if we don't like what happens, if the audience starts to fidget or we feel that, he said, I'm going to ask you to write something for that. And I said, fair enough. And then we went to the preview, of course, and to say that you could hear a pin drop in all that would not be strong enough.
Yeah.
And I remember after it all, he said, all right, no music. So he's great that, you know, he will take anything that's good for his film.
Amazing collaborator.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, amazing.
Polar Express is also one of my favorite films and scores. I mean, my kids and I, we have an annual tradition of watching the
fantastic.
Polar Express. It's such a great film and it stands the test of time and it's so great. Do you approach animation different to real action? Is that a different?
I really don't, because the biggest part of any storytelling, whether it's animation or live action, is the story and the emotional content of it. That doesn't change. If you don't feel as much for an animated character as you do for a live action actor, you're missing it somehow. Now, you do in animation very often get to accompany physical action that's impossible for a human. And so it's fun to go with that.
Yeah.
But other than that, I really don't. I see them as the telling of a story.
Yeah.
Interesting news. We are preparing Polar Express in concert.
Oh my gosh.
Where we'll be doing that with the symphony orchestra, like we're doing Back to the Future in concert.
See, this blew my mind because this is the first thing you said when you sat down is we've been preparing Back to the Future, the musical.
The musical.
I am there.
Right. No, it's, I think you're really going to have fun with this. Again, you know, it's Bob Gale has written the book. And Bob Gale and Bob Zemeckis together have been moving us through this. Yeah. We have John Randall, a Tony Award-winning stage director. We've got a fabulous cast. Glenn Ballard and I have written the songs. We've got, I think, 16 songs. And this is all stuff no one has ever heard. And it's all Back to the Future. And it's all based on Back to the Future 1.
Yeah.
And so it's just a lot of fun.
The theme's in there, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're doing a lot of that in the traditional key places in the film. But all these songs, and, you know, we're singing and dancing all through Back to the Future.
Yeah.
And it's wild and fun. And it's not spoofy.
It's
Back to the Future.
you remember about creating that theme?
Well, you know, there's a story that I mention now and again about my concept meeting with Robert Zemeckis, my first concept meeting. He was shooting The Enchantment Under the Sea dance in a church mm-hmm. on Franklin Avenue in L.A., and I walked in, probably his busiest day on the entire shoot because of all the extras, and so he's moving around and doing all this stuff, and said, yeah, Al, great, you could come visit. So he said, the score, and then he puts both hands over his head like this and says, it's got to be big. The end of the meeting. So
see ya.
Yeah, go do that. And because he had 130 people yeah. running around on the clock, so I went back and I knew it had to be big. There was no question about that, but it also had to be heroic.
Yeah,
it had to be able to be there for a sense of adventure, and also in its quiet iterations, it had to have a kind of emotional sensibility, because in the end, this is a tremendous story of friendship between Doc and Marty. I mean, it's a buddy picture where it finally goes. So anyway, I have to say that theme came out very, very quickly. It was just one of those things, and I had and remain a tremendous fan of Mr. Williams, who taught not just the film world but the public the value of beautiful, powerful themes.
Yeah.
And so I knew that whatever I found had to have this sense of size and scope and power, and yet had to be able to travel through the film in lots of different moods and iterations.
talking about big themes, I mean, that Avengers, oh my God. I mean, it, you know, that's notes that transcend generations. My six-year-old, his chest puffs out. You know, when he hears, dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, that's...
He's pretty much, in his mind, he's like, I can take on the world.
And he can.
And I love that you've given him that.
No, that's fantastic. And that's what we were hoping for there in that film. Started with the scene where they're in the town square. Mm-hmm. And that was very interesting because it was an iconic image mm-hmm. of Marvel.
Yeah.
The idea of those characters kind of shoulder to shoulder, kind of looking out as a group.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the image of the diverse, powerful warriors coming together for a common purpose. The fascinating part of that cinematically was we're in the midst of this giant crazy battle, and all of a sudden all of our heroes, they're standing still in the middle of a town square looking
checking
off.
Out.
Yeah, just they're just looking off into the distance. So, you know, the theme was constructed to have this very broad, long notes, but a sense of power. And then the strings are playing this kind of very quickly moving part because we didn't want to completely take our foot off the pedal. We're in the middle of a battle. All this tension is still going on. Interesting collection of needs that theme had to complement, and so that's how it came out. And it's fun to see how it's been embraced, and just a note or two of it, and we get it. We know
totally.
Where this is going.
And this whole relationship with the Marvel started with Captain America and working with Joe Johnson, but Kevin Feige's been a big part of that, and I'm desperate to get him on the show because I'm such a fan, and I think what he's done with this whole universe is extraordinary. And he cares a lot about music. It's a big thing for him.
It is a real big thing for him. It's one of the great joys of working with him is that you know that about him. Mm-hmm. He listens to film scores. You know, he is the biggest fan in the world of the Marvel Universe. And so everything about him is excited about all of this. And that would be a tremendous person to talk to. I mean, you can see all of the variations in the history of the Marvel universe in terms of sensibilities, the looks, the sounds, and all of that. But there has been one through line to all of it, and that's been Kevin Feige, and he is that.
Yeah,
he is the through line and the conscience and the keeper of the overall vision of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's him, and so you need to have a chance to talk to him.
You need to speak to Kevin.
Yeah, you need to speak to Kevin because it would be fabulous for everyone. And always is to hear Kevin talk about.
Well, I think this. We've had pretty much nearly every director from all the different Taika I'm speaking to for his next film and stuff. But I can't imagine how difficult it was for you, considering that the clever thing that they've done is all these different characters individually, Captain America through the score that you wrote, but through Thor and through Iron Man, they all have their own sounds.
Right.
But you had that job of bringing that that world together
through
Avengers Assemble and then through these two last films as well.
Right. Yeah, it was a very interesting, again, it was a psychological challenge. When you work on a film, very often you'll start to get the sense that it's not just a good film, but it could be something.
One of the biggest films
ever. And for instance, Back to the Future, we while we were making it, we all felt it was a really good film. Mm. But no one could ever predict the afterlife of that film. By the time we got to Avengers 1, Marvel had enjoyed a level of success where we knew that this film would be embraced by the world, and that brought a certain kind of pressure, absolutely, going in. Because now you feel like you're caring for something, and you don't want to drop it, or you don't want to bump into anything with this.
It's like carrying a newborn.
Yeah, you just don't mess this up. Yeah. By the time we got to Infinity War, and certainly at Endgame, that dynamic was out of this world.
Yeah.
Going into Endgame, I mean, I marvel, no pun intended, with the sense that I got in all of my interaction from Joe and Anthony and Kevin.
Yeah.
These were with me. I'm not saying because I only saw them with me.
Yeah.
But these were three very cool cucumbers.
Wow.
I never saw a sign of fear in their eyes. They were always willing to try, to experiment, to be playful when it was time to be playful. I mean, it blew my mind to see how the three of them kept themselves centered and moving forward, knowing what the expectation was from the world. This film had to be truly out of this world, and they just kind of carried on and soldiered through. And yet there was always a sense, you know, I always look at music, you know, we say we play music, but you know, you go into a recording studio and there's all this money being spent and all this pressure, and it's like, how are these folks really playing, you know? But they're so brilliant at what they do, they're actually playing.
Do you still get a kick when you hear your music being played by these orchestras and these?
Yeah, I do. And it's not so much that I haven't heard what it's going to sound like.
Yeah.
Because if you don't know that before it's played, there could be a big problem. But what continues to marvel me, again to use that word, is that it's this collection of human beings who have dedicated their life to perfecting an art form to the point where they can play in the midst of this high-pressured situation. And they're all there. And they do something in a concerted way that's different than pretty much anything else I've ever seen done. You know, we write music, and the language of music in terms of its notation is a very interesting event.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea of being able to that specifically express how 95 people will act in time on end of one. In bar 37, yeah. They're all going to do that. And you don't have to say a word to them. It's on the paper, and they all do it. And now that's happening thousands of times a day. It's mind-blowing. And every once in a while, I just stop to realize how magnificent that is.
Yeah. We're going to run out of time.
Okay.
But please, when you come back next year, maybe we can have chapter two.
Sure, absolutely.
Because there's so much.
That.
I mean, some of the films as well that I grew up with, you know, Flight of the Navigator,
yeah.
The Abyss,
yeah.
All those films, and Ready Player One as well. We can maybe chat about them.
I would love to.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. And thank you for all of this great work you do, having filmmakers have a chance to speak to people. And
are you kidding?
No.
I'm a film fan. This is I'm living the dream.
No, well, that's great. Well, we're happy to have you dreaming in public.
Thanks, Adam.
Okay,
thank you.
The main theme from The Abyss by Alan Silvestri, rounding off our latest episode of Soundtracking with the legendary composer. My huge thanks to Alan for taking the time to talk to us. He really is an absolutely adorable man. Hopefully, we'll get him back for part two when The Witches comes out. Now, we'll put together a Spotify playlist for the show, which you can access via edithbowman.com. My website is also the place to catch up with all of our previous shows, including my chats with Robert Zemeckis and the Russo Brothers. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And do check out our YouTube channel too, where we started putting up plenty of bonus material. Next up, Andy Muschietti joins me to discuss It Chapter 2. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.